Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Star Fox Grand Prix was probably the biggest rumor of the entire Switch generation. It's almost hard to believe that was 5 years ago, but we finally cracked the code. We talked to Retro Studios staff, gaming journalists like Jason Schreier, who chased the original story, and a few social media influencers who broke the news, so to speak. This game had a whole media frenzy around it, and millions of Nintendo fans were convinced the rumors were true. But what if we told you the whole thing was entirely, utterly fake? But how is that even possible? And who started the hoax? Well, buckle up, because we're about to take you on a wild ride. Now, let's go back to the beginning. In case you need a reminder about all the hype around Star Fox Grand Prix, this was YouTube back in 2018.
But if it does turn out to be accurate, it'll be super intriguing to see if Retro can do to Star Fox what it's done to Metroid and Donkey Kong, that is, revive the franchise.
Star Fox Grand Prix that's supposedly being made by Retro Studios because lots of people seem to think it's true.
We're gonna see a Star Fox Grand Prix announcement tomorrow.
Star Fox Grand Prix.
Star Fox Grand Prix.
Star Fox Grand Prix.
Star Fox Grand Prix.
Star Fox Grand Prix?
Star Fox Grand Prix could get the you know, has-beens or the second-rate characters.
Right.
Cameos.
Not to mention all the news articles, tweets, and podcasts. And we're not dogging on these guys, by the way. They were just reporting on a viral rumor, and in a few cases, quite skeptically. But you get the point. Star Fox Grand Prix was on the tip of every tongue that summer, but an official announcement never came. 5 years pass and some fans are still wondering what happened exactly. Since then, most people subscribe to one of two theories. The first one is that it was Nintendo themselves who started a fake rumor as a way to sniff out leakers in their midst. There's been a lot of secrets leaking out of Nintendo over the years, and some folks think this was all a ruse to plug it up. The other theory is that some gaming journalists got a sneak peek at Star Fox in Starlink Battle for Atlas and just got confused and thought it was a Star Fox racing game. We spent almost 2 years digging into this story and exploring these theories, so we'll walk you through our investigation. So, what about the popular theory that Nintendo started the rumor themselves? After all, that's what Google says happened. Initially, you might think making up fake games could negatively impact sales. For example, if everyone thought a Star Fox racing game was coming soon, maybe they'd save their money instead of buying something else. In that case, Nintendo would actually lose money. So we spoke to former Retro Studios senior producer Brian Walker. He's also worked for Activision, Embracer Group, and several other publishers. We asked Brian, do companies actually spread fake leaks about their own games?
I have seen it happen at other publishers where they'll let something, quote, leak, unquote, or they'll identify, they'll tag a bit of information as having been delivered to a very short list of people waiting for that to surface and then just doing some forensics to narrow down where that came from. I have at other publishers seen that firsthand. Not in Nintendo, though.
So fake corporate leaks do happen, but not necessarily at Nintendo. That's definitely not what happened this time, though, because we found out who created the title Star Fox Grand Prix. It was the same guy who created this infamous logo. It wasn't anyone at Nintendo, it was the YouTube and Twitch streamer Roger's Base. But this reveal is just the tip of the iceberg. Some of the journalists who covered the Grand Prix rumors told us they suspected the whole thing was a hoax by Roger and one other social media influencer we'll get to in a minute. After all, Roger pulled a similar stunt back in 2009 when he made a Professor Layton Twitter account many believe was officially run by Nintendo. That was a long time ago, so we checked in with Roger to see if he was up to his old tricks. And he admitted that yeah, he made the Grand Prix logo. It was just a simple edit of the official Star Fox Guard logo, photoshopped in about 5 minutes. As for the title, the 1966 film Grand Prix is one of his dad's favorite movies, so it just kind of popped into his head.
Grand Prix!
Roger may have cooked up the name and the logo, but he said he wasn't responsible for the hoax. Innocently, he made a logo mock-up to use in a YouTube thumbnail, nothing out of the ordinary for his channel. Roger never ended up finishing that video, but it was gonna be a rumor that circulated back in 2012, when people were saying Retro was making a Star Fox / Metroid crossover game. History doesn't often repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. We'll come back to Roger's hijinks in a minute, but first, let's get Retro on the record about both projects. Again, here's Brian Walker, senior producer at Retro, when that rumor was going around. He called the Star Fox / Metroid crossover clickbait, pure and simple. As for Star Fox Grand Prix,
I wish sometimes that we were working on as many cool things as the fans think we were. To this day, I have people come up and say, yeah, we heard about this, and yeah, it's a shame it was canceled. I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. It sounds cool, though. Let's do it. Kid Icarus, Star Fox Racing. I mean, there's not a Nintendo stable or IP that at some point hadn't been associated with something that Retro was supposedly working on.
Brian left Retro many years ago, so we got into contact with a dev who's still at Retro today. They wanted to remain anonymous, but told us, there have been pitches related to that IP, but I have never heard of any racing project like that at Retro. We found one of those pitches, Star Fox Armada, which we covered extensively in a recent video. But as far as Grand Prix or a Metroid crossover, multiple people from Retro say they never existed. Maybe, though, you don't want to take Retro's word for it. Maybe you think they're lying or under NDA. So let's keep digging down to the roots of the rumor. Pretty much all those news articles about Star Fox Grand Prix dropped on the same day, May 14th, 2018. They all cited two sources, a 4chan thread revealing the game's logo, which we've already established was made by Roger's Base, and the other was Reddit leaker Das Vergeben, who claimed Retro was making a Star Fox racing game, which was like Diddy Kong Racing mixed with F-Zero, featuring an adventure mode, boss fights, and a hub world. Journalists thought that Vergeben's prediction was worthy of being their cited source because he'd correctly predicted Smash Ultimate Fighters in the past. His record wasn't spotless, though. He said Halo's Master Chief was going to get added, but Kazuya got announced instead. We offered Vergeben opportunities to give his side of the Grand Prix story since early 2022, but he dodged our questions, and soon after, he completely disappeared from the internet. But whether or not he ever had legit insider information about anything's not particularly important. Like most self-proclaimed leakers, sometimes he just piggybacks on other people's rumors, which is exactly what happened with Star Fox Grand Prix. We're talking about Vergeben because he was the cited source for those news articles, but in reality, a lot of those journalists heard the rumor weeks before. You see, when Roger made that fake logo, he showed it to three of his friends. One of those friends was a Twitter rumor monger with a bunch of followers. We've been asked to keep his identity a secret so he doesn't get hate brigaded, and some information we were only able to obtain because we promised to keep him anonymous. There's plenty of clout seekers who don't use their real names and share fake leaks on Twitter, and it doesn't really matter which one it was this time. We gotta call him something, though, so let's call him Waddle Dee Knows. We talked to Waddle Dee, and he admitted that after he got the fake logo from Roger, he sent it to IGN. Then IGN published the logo and the rumor. They also shared it on their podcast.
I think we have the logo here. It was actually passed along to us to Star Fox Grand Prix. There you can see it.
Waddle Dee sent it to some other folks too, and to make his claims more credible, he showed them an Instagram photo of Roger outside Retro HQ and said Roger got a sneak peek at the game because he's a YouTube star. In reality, Roger had been at a separate event literally down the street in Austin, Texas, and just swung by Retro for a photo op. He didn't get a sneak peek at anything, heck, he'd even walk inside the building. That was March 2018, not long before Roger made the logo and the rumor went public. Waddle Dee confessed to sending the logo to IGN, but denied the rest of those details. They were, however, confirmed to us by people he sent stuff to. From there, the rumor was big enough that even if it couldn't be verified, the rumor itself was news. When one outlet covers a rumor, it basically serves as a smokescreen and encourages other outlets to cover it too. Journalists were sending the logo to each other in group chats, rewording each other's articles, and practically every news site under the sun ended up covering it. So why would Waddle Dee Knows do this? When we talked to him, he said it was just a mistake, and he thought Retro really did give Roger a sneak peek at Star Fox Grand Prix. So he told people about it. His side of the story is basically that he was gullible and made some foolish decisions. The whole thing was just an accident caused by poor judgment. He wasn't entirely forthcoming though, and some of the things he said were probably untrue. Some of the folks he contacted believe it was all intentional and he did it for clout, wanting to establish himself as a known entity and a source so he'd be the kind of guy IGN seeks out for information. Others told us he wanted to tweet about Star Fox Grand Prix, then have it show up in the news a few days later so he'd look like a legit leaker. He could then say he broke the story before the big news sites. It's impossible to say for certain what was going on in his head, especially since a lot of tweets got deleted. In fact, he was actively deleting tweets while we were talking to him. And without a full confession, we can't 100% confirm his motivations. Based on prior statements and actions, though, the motive appears to be the pursuit of internet clout. Twitter followers, likes, retweets, and that warm, fuzzy feeling of being somebody important. All that said, this was 5 years ago, and he isn't a Twitter leaker anymore, so please don't go hate tweeting people you suspect might have been the real Waddle Dee. The purpose of this video is to find the truth behind the Switch generation's biggest rumor, not to punish one guy for just lying on the internet. As for Roger, he made the logo and the title, but we couldn't find any evidence he did anything dishonest. He said he never claimed to get a sneak peek at Grand Prix, and no one we talked to ever heard him make that claim, not even Waddle Dee. Roger was very forthcoming throughout our investigation and said there's no way he'd jeopardize his Nintendo ambassadorship to leak an upcoming game. It's worth noting though, Waddle Dee might not have been the only person deliberately hoaxing. The logo posted on 4chan and published by several outlets was slightly altered from what Roger made. The R wing was cropped off, a TM was added, and the bottom font was different. Another change was the file name text underneath, and the fact that it was photographed. It's kind of a cliche at this point that leaks appear more believable when they're snapped with a phone camera, as if the leaker just barely had time when no one else was looking. Waddle Dee might have made those edits himself, or it might have been someone who got the logo downstream from him. Waddle Dee denied editing the logo, so maybe it was another rumor monger with similar motivations, or it was just 4chan trolls who did it for the lols. Who exactly is responsible for the 4chan logo is a detail we couldn't quite nail down. It's not especially important, but we wanted to address it to leave no stone unturned. Regardless, it was definitely derived from the logo Waddle Dee got from Roger. The similarities, timing, and of course the title, Star Fox Grand Prix, are too much to be just a coincidence. However, as convenient as it be to lay all the blame on one man, some blame might need to be shared. We said there were two prevailing theories earlier. Nintendo staged the leak to sniff out leakers, which we already covered, and the others that confused journalists saw Star Fox in Starlink Battle for Atlas and thought it was Star Fox Grand Prix. The second theory arose because the timing made sense. The rumor went around in May 2018, and Star Fox in Starlink was publicly announced 1 month later in June. So maybe some journalists got an early sneak peek and got their wires crossed. We didn't initially believe it though, because how could someone get invited by Ubisoft for a sneak peek at Starlink and come out thinking Retro Studios showed them Grand Prix? It's not like they're scrounging for scoops spying through windows, so we initially figured a mix-up was unlikely. Especially since Starlink's Racing Mode DLC wasn't released till a year later. But apparently, that actually did happen. A senior journalist at one of the biggest outlets got a closed-doors preview of Starlink, but told other journalists that Retro showed him a Star Fox racing game, or at least that's what those other journos told us. When we questioned the senior writer about it, he said yeah, he saw Starlink, but never claimed he saw Grand Prix. We weren't sure if we could believe him though. Frankly, a lot of people we spoke to have lied to us. That's partly why this video took almost 2 years to make. One person would say a colleague did or said X, then when we went to corroborate, that colleague then denied it. Only one of them could be telling the truth. Some of the folks caught up in this story have every incentive to cover their tracks or downplay their involvement. We don't want to paint with too broad a brush though. Some journalists were very helpful and provided us with leads off the record. This video wouldn't have been possible without their insight, so we're definitely not saying all journos are bad or anything like that. As for media coverage, the situation was best described to us by investigative journalist Jason Schreier. He was one of the guys who covered the rumor the same day as every other outlet on May 14th. To his credit, he later provided a public update saying his one insider source later backpedaled on the game being real, and that a lot of Nintendo rumor mongers talk to each other, so sometimes what appears to journalists as multiple sources might actually be coming from a ring of people sharing information with each other. Based on our investigation, that seems to be exactly what happened here. Speaking to us more recently, Schreier said he suspects his one source heard the rumor from that same ring of gossipers who had all received the same photoshopped fake logo. Star Fox Grand Prix never existed. It was a rumor sparked by one guy on Twitter, proliferated by gaming journalists, YouTubers, and other piggybacking leakers, then gulped down by fans who wanted it to be true. If there's a lesson to be learned, it's that when you see a dozen gaming sites all covering the same story on the same day, they probably didn't have time to independently verify if any of it was actually true. Especially when their sources are Reddit leakers, 4chan threads, and other journalists. Some rumors do turn out to be true, but Star Fox Grand Prix was a hoax. Thankfully, we can finally lay the rumor to rest. As for what Retro was actually working on, that remains a mystery. We've talked to more than a dozen current and former Retro devs. We got design documents and alpha footage for projects that never saw the light of day, like Heroes of Hyrule, Metroid Tactics, Star Fox Armada, and some we haven't even talked about yet. But whatever that cancelled game really was around 2018, well, that remains elusive even to us. Let us know in the comments if you've got a hunch, or if you're a retro dev, hit us up on our Twitter.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
After years of shooting down hopeful game revivals and allegedly laughing buyout offers out of the room, Nintendo's management has earned itself a reputation for being discerning and difficult to pitch to. In many instances, this approach has served the company well, but every so often, they have been known to unwittingly let a big business opportunity slip through their fingertips. In this video, I'll be going over several case studies of such a phenomenon. These are some of the big games that Nintendo turned down. 2008 was a year of great instability for the game industry. Rocked by the global financial crisis, many companies were forced to close their doors for good. Toys for Bob, meanwhile, was challenging themselves to invent a new IP during a period when the stakes were higher than ever. Their experiments combining RFID chips with homemade action figures resulted in a prototype that caught the attention of Activision's executives. They blended this original property with one Activision had not long since acquired, Spyro, resulting in the first Skylanders game. The majority of Activision's executives were apparently bullish on the proposed new title, but still sought to offset as much risk as possible. They directed Toys for Bob to court Nintendo for a potential co-publishing arrangement to spread the costs and employ their expertise. Believing it had the potential to succeed on their platform, the Wii, Activision wanted to offer Nintendo a chance to get in on the ground floor of their new product. After all, the two publishers already had a strong working relationship, with a co-marketing deal already in place for the Wii generation. Paul Ritchie and other Toys for Bob staff presented their ideas to Nintendo of America in 2008, who were apparently impressed by the demonstration. Despite this enthusiasm, a risk-averse Nintendo declined to invest in this unproven new IP. The deal would have offered Nintendo a percentage in a venture that would go on to become highly profitable for Activision, spawning numerous sequels and topping over $3 billion in revenue. Skylanders helped spawn a Toys to Life craze throughout the 2010s that ultimately fizzled out in 2016. As sales slumped year on year, Activision cancelled its next major installment. Speaking to Polygon in 2014, Ritchie recalled his incredulity at Nintendo's decision. Clearly, they have got properties well suited to this world. Why it is that they didn't rush in here will probably haunt them for the rest of their days. As the success of Skylanders exploded, Nintendo eventually did backtrack on their decision, at least to an extent. The two companies partnered for the Wii U version of Skylanders Superchargers, which introduced guest playable characters Hammer Slam Bowser and Turbo Charge Donkey Kong. Both had their own Skylanders figures, which could also function as amiibo. For years, Sega's Yakuza series was associated chiefly with Sony platforms, beginning on PS2 and landing exclusively on them for a number of years. But as series creator Toshihiro Nagoshi has explained, this was not for lack of trying. After finally receiving the green light from Sega following multiple failed attempts, the team found themselves presenting their concept to console manufacturers, including Nintendo. The game was proposed to Nintendo, which was led by Satoru Iwata at the time, as a possible title for the GameCube. According to Nagoshi, however, Nintendo staff didn't see the potential in his game, along with every other platform holder. Even Sony turned down the initial proposal for Yakuza, as Nagoshi explained in an interview with CVG. For the market at the time, they thought it was too niche. They were worried it wouldn't sell, and I got quite a disappointing reply from them. But I kept pestering them, and eventually they gave it a closer look. That's because they saw the passion I had for the game, rather than anything to do with whether or not it would sell. Ultimately, the Yakuza series did make its debut on Nintendo hardware years later, albeit in a limited form. The first two games were re-released together in HD on the Wii U, exclusively in Japan. This release, which was labelled by Nagoshi as an experiment to gauge the level of interest among Wii U players in the series, performed poorly. It was believed to have sold fewer than 2,000 copies during its first week on the market, leading the director to brand it as a huge failure in 2018. As the skateboarding game genre dawned in the 1990s, a number of different companies found themselves attempting to figure out how to best translate the burgeoning sport into video game form. For many publishers at the time, however, a skateboarding game remained a hard sell. To help grease the wheels, skating icon Tony Hawk was brought on to lend some credibility to the endeavor. Partnering with a PC developer in the late 90s, this very early concept for a skating game with the names of real-life pro skaters attached was pitched around to a variety of Western publishers. As Tony Hawk himself revealed in the 2020 documentary Pretending I'm a Superman, the Tony Hawk Video Game Story, these initial endeavors were met with universal skepticism. Publishers were hesitant about the prospects of a skateboarding game, believing the sport to be unpopular and therefore unlikely to be the basis of a successful video game. While these unsolicited pitches went nowhere, there was one company that did take a proactive interest in Tony Hawk's early efforts and invited him to present a proposal: Nintendo. The Japanese game giant had caught wind of the project they'd been seeking to produce and met with him to see if it had potential as a Nintendo exclusive. As Hawk recounted, their ideas didn't get far and were unceremoniously shot down by their higher-ups, who ended up being similarly concerned about its sales potential. It was shortly after this venture fizzled out that he was contacted by a different party entirely, Activision. They had contracted the Californian studio Neversoft to create a prototype for a skating game. Upon playing the demo himself, Tony Hawk's impressions were very positive, complimenting its intuitive and approachable gameplay. He soon agreed to come on board as the face of the game. Tony Hawk's Pro Skater released in 1999 to widespread acclaim and commercial success. It would go on to receive a myriad of sequels, raking in over $1.4 billion in revenue as of 2019. E3 2011 saw the reveal of the Nintendo Wii U, a first showing that also announced an infamously ill-fated collaboration. EA's John Riccitiello took to the stage to pledge his company's support for Nintendo's system in no uncertain terms. The CEO bigged up their arrangement as an unprecedented partnership and told players to imagine a variety of EA franchises on the new console at their very best. Ultimately, though, it was in the imaginations of Nintendo players that some of these games would remain. In spite of Peter Moore's insistence later that year that his company believed in the Wii U and its apparently extensive online features, EA's support for the system was limited to only 4 games, all of which were ports from other systems. The apparent turnaround from unprecedented partnership to a small series of ports that were commonly criticized for missing features has led many players to speculate that there was a fallout between the two parties after that initial 2011 announcement. While the dramatics of these events may have been overstated, there is some truth to the rumors after all. Sources close to the talks indicate that there were fundamental disagreements about the direction of the Wii U between EA and Nintendo. These concerned its online infrastructure, which EA apparently wanted to have a bigger hand in, and how powerful the system should be. One EA developer had asserted that the company was looking for a bigger piece of the pie when it came to the Wii U's online, and had even pushed for it to implement their EA Origin service in some form. Despite having initiated the discussions themselves, Nintendo was not willing to agree to some of EA's terms. For one, Nintendo hoped to keep manufacturing costs down, and this meant less powerful hardware than was initially discussed, an apparent point of contention for EA. Inside sources described the outcome as an amicable disagreement that left EA steadily backing off from some of their previous commitments out of concern for how successful the Wii U would be. In the aftermath of discussions breaking down, a number of potential EA games for the Wii U ended up being scrapped. Among those prototyped was a gamepad-centric version of SimCity and Crysis 3. One of the last nails in the coffin for EA support on the console came after attempts to get their Frostbite 2 engine running on it yielded some apparently poor results. Titles using the engine subsequently never appeared on the platform. These hiccups notwithstanding, Nintendo and EA are said to have entered talks again at the end of that generation in 2016, as the Nintendo Switch loomed. This time around, EA sought more reassurance that Nintendo would do more to court their typical audience on the console through its first-party efforts. Sources privy to the negotiations said that EA wanted to have a hand in hardware sales yet again. again, proposing a FIFA Switch bundle be sold with their title packaged in. Nintendo turned them down once again, limiting their initial commitment to the system. Nintendo and Platinum Games have over the years cultivated a strong working relationship, beginning with their partnership over games like The Wonderful 101. However, there have also been a number of titles that Platinum was unable to receive the green light on when pitching to them. One notable title to slip through the cracks, according to former Platinum developers, was their fantasy action RPG epic, Scalebound. Sources claim that the title was pitched around to a variety of different publishers, and this included Nintendo themselves early on in its lifespan. Already engaged in development on multiple other games with Platinum, Nintendo staff simply weren't interested in the initial concept and politely turned it down. Instead, it would end up being Microsoft who picked up the game, looking to produce more Japanese games for their then-upcoming system, the Xbox One. Following several rocky years of development, the ambitious project fell apart in late 2016 amid tensions between the two companies. Platinum would instead continue to partner with Nintendo on successful titles such as 2019's Astral Chain. Delivering one quirky invention after the other, Japanese game giant Nintendo has cemented its reputation in the industry for out-of-the-box thinking. And while success hasn't always resulted from it, this ethos has often carried over to its marketing. For this video, I'll be recalling some of the unconventional lengths the company has gone to in order to expose their products to a wider audience. These are some of the less remembered and more unusual marketing stunts of Nintendo's past. We begin in 2002, the year of the GameCube's launch in PAL regions. While the console was finding success in the US throughout its first months on the market, it was struggling to find its footing elsewhere. Ahead of its UK release, Nintendo revised its sales forecasts for the region downwards in a preemptive reaction to low pre-order numbers. Just 2 weeks ahead of the Cube street date, they even shaved £20 off its original price to sweeten the deal. Ultimately, the launch failed to set the UK on fire, and Nintendo found itself plotting out new and experimental ways to capture more of the market. As the October 2002 release of notable exclusive Super Mario Sunshine neared, a plan was hatched involving a celebrity sponsorship and hair dye. For this endeavour, the marketing team at Nintendo UK enlisted the help of British television presenter Des Lynam. In reference to the GameCube's purple exterior, Lynam dyed his mustache a bright purple to mark the release of Mario's latest adventure. He was pictured posing with two models and a Mario mascot when this deal was announced, and later appeared prominently on billboards throughout London. "I'm pleased that the true worth of my mustache has finally been realized," Lynam said to the press. "It's something I've worn proudly for years, despite what fashions have come and gone. I consider Mario a long-serving brother-in-arms, and long may we both wear our fine facial hair with pride." Andy Williams, a spokesperson from Nintendo UK, added, "I can only hope the purple comes out of Des's mustache and that he doesn't become addicted to playing Super Mario Sunshine at the expense of the sporting world as a result of this." The stunt, which lasted through the month of Sunshine's release, cost the company at least £100,000, according to The Guardian. The game later attained relative success around the world, but failed to live up to Nintendo's original hopes.
High-quality games like Mario Sunshine and Metroid Prime did not fully meet our expectations.
Another more successful device that the gaming hardware titan was pushing around this time was the Game Boy Advance. In a bid to gain further publicity for the system, Nintendo found itself entering the world of extreme sports. They began sponsoring competitive events in the early 2000s, including the 2001 Wakeboarding World Championships. Their attempt to tap into this market was taken to the next level in 2002. Nintendo started sponsoring a number of extreme sports athletes from the UK. This assembly of daredevils became known as the Game Boy Advance Extreme Team. Among them were championship winners from various different sports, including wakeboarder Dan Knott and snowboarder Melanie Liando. Each donned Game Boy Advance branded gear at events throughout the year and were profiled on their favorite GBA titles. This promotion attracted little attention from the gaming press of the era, but was notable for facilitating some record-breaking stunts. One member of the GBA Extreme team, Kirsty Jones, became the first person to successfully kite surf across the Irish Sea in September 2002. Nintendo's pattern of unusual GameCube promos also encompassed a series of quote-unquote immersive advertisements for Pikmin. Looking to get the word out about Miyamoto's latest creation, Nintendo's international branches opted for some real-world marketing gimmicks, starting with Nintendo of America. On the 12th of December 2001, NOA announced the sale of a flower dubbed the Pikmin Flower, which would later be sold throughout North America in 2002. Made possible through a partnership with Syngenta, the Pikmin flower sported five white petals, intended to resemble the buds that bloom on the heads of Pikmin. Nintendo UK, on the other hand, went about organising a series of real-life performance pieces. A troupe of actors was paid to visit public places around England, dressed as different colours of Pikmin. These costumes included face paint and Pikmin onesies. They could be seen following around unsuspecting members of the public in cities such as London and Liverpool, mimicking their behaviour from the video game. They later attended game retail stores on the day of the title's launch, and even brought a potted Pikmin flower to show shoppers. The company took its trend of creative marketing stunts even further with a large competition to promote GameCube exclusive Eternal Darkness Sanity's Requiem. Nintendo encouraged amateur filmmakers from around the world to get involved and create a short psychological horror film of their own to compete. Fans were instructed to invoke the game's themes of hallucination, insanity, and black magic. The victor would receive a cash prize of $20,000 and have their film featured at a major film festival. A panel of judges was assembled to choose their favourites, which included Donnie Darko director Richard Kelly and Dennis Diak, the then president of Eternal Darkness developer Silicon Knights. The top entries were originally hosted on a Nintendo-owned website named EternalDarknessFilms.com and have since been uploaded to YouTube. These included Rewind, a film about a haunted video rental store, and Dinner with Kip, which followed a paranoid woman being driven insane by her boyfriend. However, it was a movie named Unloved that was crowned the winner. This short story centered around a mad scientist who puppeteers a woman's corpse as his lover. It was made by Patrick Daughters, who went on to become a noted music video director. The competition was held in association with media production company Hypnotic, which later purchased the rights to an Eternal Darkness movie that ultimately fizzled out in pre-production. Later into the lifespan of the console, Nintendo of America arrived at the idea of helping out those in need while promoting one of their landmark titles. Paper Mario: The Thousand Year Door made its debut in 2004, and their marketing department chose to make a charitable donation inspired by its title. The company partnered with Habitat for Humanity, a non-profit dedicated to tackling homelessness and poverty around the world. Nintendo aided its housing projects in Florida by donating 1,000 doors in honor of the new Paper Mario. A photo op for the event was captured by NGC magazine in November 2004, which saw a Mario mascot helping hold up a door being fitted by workers. George Harrison, Nintendo of America's then senior vice president of marketing, commented on the event, "We trust this contribution will open the door for hundreds of families to enjoy a better life." These endeavors followed in the footsteps of other quirky promotions for the series, such as this print ad from 2001, showing a version of the titular character that could be cut out, jokingly labeled Free Demo. The Thousand Year Door attempted something similar when another print ad was produced with instructions on how to fold it up into a paper airplane, a reference to the plane Mario ability from the game. That same year, another wordplay-filled series of stunts was employed for rhythm-beat game Donkey Konga. In statements to the press, Nintendo talked up an advertising campaign which they playfully referred to as guerrilla marketing. This kicked off in July 2004 with a Donkey Kong mascot wandering about London Zoo to announce a UK tour called Donkey Kong's Beach Road Trip. For the following several months, Nintendo UK toured major cities up and down England in a large beach-themed truck filled with GameCube kiosks. Visitors could try out Donkey Konga ahead of its UK release, or a number of other impending titles such as Animal Crossing. The tour vehicle brought with it a pop-up beach bar and a number of Nintendo-themed carnival attractions. These included Pikmin Slingshot, in which players had to catapult plush Pikmin through basketball hoops. Inflatable Pokemon decorated the surrounding area. Attendees could also apply to star in a wacky live-action TV spot for Donkey Konga at these events. The chosen applicants competed in a four-player versus match shot in a high-energy game show setting. The resulting ad ran alongside UK airings of the Japanese game show Takeshi's Castle throughout 2004. The Simeon-centric media blitz came to a head on a rainy October afternoon in London. 50 actors in gorilla costumes loudly invaded Trafalgar Square, brandishing Donkey Konga-branded bongos and holding up placards which read, "Do the Konga." 2005 saw the release of Nintendo's hit pet simulator, Nintendogs. The game had long legs financially, receiving numerous marketing pushes. This all started with some innovative digital hooks and live events. In September 2005, New York City's Nintendo World Store marked the game's release with a launch day party. Producer Shigeru Miyamoto was on hand to meet the first 200 fans in line and sign their copies of the game. His appearance was advertised online ahead of the event, leading to over 1,500 excited fans lining the street in anticipation, with some camping out several days in advance. While not everyone was able to meet the famed designer, every person buying the new game was able to get in on a celebrity cameo of another kind. Through Bark Mode, a feature in Nintendogs using the system's wireless communications, they could unlock the game's Jack Russell Terrier breed, a digital bonus that was initially exclusive to this event. In addition to this, they could download Bentley, the Nintendog of Napoleon Dynamite star Hayley Duff. The pup brought with it a pair of sunglasses and a voice clip from the actor herself.
Hi, I'm Hayley Duff. My Nintendo Bentley has a special gift for you. Have fun playing Nintendo.
This downloadable was later made available at GameStop for a limited time. The two companies together also made a charitable donation of $50,000 to the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in the game's honor. Across the pond, Nintendo UK partnered with retailer HMV for a historic launch party in London. For the first time in the store's history, dogs were not only allowed to enter, but owners were actively encouraged to bring them along. Dog owners received a Nintendogs goodie bag for their participation and could meet a real-life stand-in for HMV's mascot, Nipper the Dog. Several days later, the launch was followed up by an event known as the Puppy Party, a Nintendogs-themed celebration hosted by celebrity wildlife enthusiast Bill Oddie. Also in attendance were then-famous British canines such as Schmeichel from UK TV soap Coronation Street. Looking to further expand upon its vast marketing efforts for the DS, it was in 2006 that Nintendo set its sights on Hollywood. Through a partnership with the Weinstein Company, the DS and its games became prominently featured in the 2006 spy movie Stormbreaker, an adaptation of the Anthony Horowitz novel of the same name. The modified Hot Rod Red DS is used throughout the movie by its protagonist Alex Rider, a teenage spy. The device is introduced to him by Smithers, portrayed by Stephen Fry, who reveals its various functions. By inserting different DS cartridges, Alex is able to access different espionage tools, including an application for eavesdropping on conversations remotely. Also featured in the scene are several background product placements for DS games like WarioWare Touched, and this Nintendo-themed gag.
This one here turns it into a bug finder, and sonic intensifier means you can hear conversations through solid walls for up to 250 yards. This one turns the whole device into a smoke bomb. has a 5-second delay.
That's pretty cool. And what about Mario Kart?
Mario Kart is a game. We thought you might like it for the flight.
The gadget is used numerous times throughout the film before being ultimately discarded by the main character, who uses it to stun armed guards with its smokescreen ability. Months into the lifespan of Nintendo's Wii U, the company dropped Game & Wario, a party title spin-off featuring Mario's flatulent foe, Wario. The game failed to shift the needle for Nintendo's struggling console and did itself financially underperform. Despite this, the company did manage to garner praise from various outlets for its unique marketing approach. Mocking the burgeoning trend of video game developers crowdfunding their games via Kickstarter, it was in May 2013 that Nintendo made their own parody site called Crowdfarter. It was launched by a trailer voiced by Charles Martinet himself, in which Wario appeals to fans to support his new game on Crowdfarter.
Just give me your money so I can make my dreams come true. Thank you very much.
As opposed to donating money to the site, people were encouraged to spread the word on social media and tweet hashtag Crowdfarter. In return, they gradually unlocked community rewards for their participation. These included digital bonuses like wallpaper, a ringtone of Wario farting, and eventually a new trailer for Game & Wario. Just over 8,200 tweets were posted in support for the game overall, and the crowdfarter was marked as fully funded when the game launched in June 2013.
Did you know? Though Donkey Kong Country Returns was in development in 2008, talks for the game actually began much earlier. In April 2004, Retro Studios brought up the idea of working on a Donkey Kong game after finishing Metroid Prime 2, but the idea was shot down. Instead having them follow up with a third Prime game, producer Kensuke Tanabe said Nintendo relied on Retro Studios to make games that Japanese studios couldn't. Later, in April 2008, Nintendo veteran Shigeru Miyamoto was in talks with Tanabe about making a new Donkey Kong Country. He asked about finding a developer suited for the job, and Tanabe recalled Retro's president Michael Kelbaugh. Kelbaugh had previously worked on the DKC series with Rare and said he'd love to work on it again. Tanabe himself had also worked on DKC's Japanese localization. At this time, several core Retro staff had left the company, leaving them open for new projects. Had those personnel not left to pursue other interests, the opportunity to work on Donkey Kong might not have gone to Retro. In an addition of Iwata asks, former Nintendo president Satoru Iwata referred to this set of circumstances as fate. As a result of this, Returns went under the codename F8 during development, a name coined by Kelbaugh. Retro didn't feel at all skeptical about going from Metroid to Donkey Kong, and the brighter atmosphere of the DK series reflected their outlook on the project. Occasionally, they'd make art that was more Metroid than DK, but their mantra throughout was to keep things fun and whimsical. The team played through the country and land games to get a good grasp on the gameplay, as well as Banjo-Kazooie for good measure. Wario Land on Virtual Boy was also a huge inspiration, as it featured platforming that switched between the foreground and background, much like Returns does. Miyamoto was heavily involved in Returns' creation, giving suggestions for gameplay ideas and animation details. Retro affectionately referred to him as Master Yoda, and he had told them that Donkey Kong was his baby and that they better get it right. Miyamoto came up with the hand slap move for the original DKC and made a subtle change to it for Returns. Initially, Retro made a simple animation for the move, and he suggested it have more of a 1-2 rhythm, and they were surprised as to how that subtle suggestion made the move feel so much better to perform. The game's blow mechanic also came from Miyamoto after playing an early demo. For 10 minutes, he ran back and forth with DK, seeing how he moved, and took notice of the final frames of animation where he'd turn and kick up dust. Miyamoto said it looked like DK was exhaling, then suggested he should blow on things. It was a new way to interact with the environment, and the suggestion confused the team at first. During the 2011 Game Developers Conference, director Brian Walker had this to say. When we got back to Retro and pitched this to the team, the lights didn't instantly come on. The general response was, "What the hell?" But after we experimented with it, we saw how it turned out to be a fun feature, and it was really consistent with the fun, whimsical tone of the game. Miyamoto wanted Retro to focus on a single-player experience first and foremost, but Tanabe wanted Returns to have good multiplayer. fully realizing what couldn't be done in the original games, two players at the same time. However, a second target would increase the game's character animation count and add an extra layer to the game's camera system and level geometry. Multiplayer also acted as a way to separate returns from the previous DK game, Donkey Kong Jungle Beat. Interestingly, where the original Jungle Beat distanced itself from the Country games, the Wii version of Jungle Beat featured more elements from Country. This included barrel cannons and even DK's ducking animation from the original DKC. Jungle Beat may have inspired the beatdowns at the end of a boss fight in Returns, and level end jingles from Jungle Beat play at the end of a Returns level. Development on Tropical Freeze started shortly after Returns was released. Retro initially denied any hints of a sequel, but they still had unfinished business with the series. The Wii U hardware would allow them to do things that weren't possible in Returns, such as have a dynamic 3D camera. It would also allow the Kong's detailed fur, which was in fact requested by Iwata. That said, there were just as many ideas that didn't make it into Tropical Freeze, with Tanabe saying he would have liked to experiment with the series' animal buddies. Another idea the team wanted to see was bringing back series composer David Wise. For Returns, Miyamoto didn't want the music to be changed, so the soundtrack was mainly comprised of remixes from the original Country. Wise was contacted by Kelbaugh for Returns' score, but he was unavailable at the time, so the job was handed to Kenji Yamamoto. Shortly after Returns' launch, Kelbaugh privately met with Wise at the Game Developers Conference and asked if he'd be available for a future project with an old friend. Wise immediately agreed and got to work with Yamamoto on Tropical Freeze's score. For the Grassland Groove track, some of the vocals were supplied by Nintendo staff who were regulars in choirs. Yamamoto recruited them and had them sing the track's choir segments, with Wise saying it gave the song a unique charm. Wise has also said that the Seashore War track was originally made for the Savannah levels, and that it's his personal favorite track he's ever composed, though it's a track different from what's heard in the final game. To coincide with the UK release of Returns, the game was promoted with UK retailers Game and GameStation, where the first 20 customers could get a copy of the title in exchange for a bunch of bananas at select stores. This isn't the only bit of fun that was had with the game. Returns' Foggy Fumes level has several Nintendo Easter eggs. A silhouette of Crocomire's skull from Super Metroid can be seen in the background, and the character Mr. Game & Watch makes a cameo appearance later on. Early in the level is a silhouette of the 25-meter stage from the Donkey Kong arcade game. Similarly, Tropical Freeze has a reference to Donkey Kong 3 in the Fruity Factory level, featuring a replica of the game's first stage in the background. Stanley the Bugman's bug sprayer also appears in the foreground. The level Busted Bayou even features Samus's gunship ensnared in the trees. The secret level themes in both games also incorporate music from Donkey Kong Jr. Donkey Kong's idle animation of him playing a Nintendo handheld has been updated with each of Retro's games, starting with a DS Lite in Return, and upgrading to a 3DS XL in the Wii U version of Tropical Freeze. The Nintendo Switch port fittingly has him play the Switch in handheld mode. The animation may have been inspired by an event at the San Francisco Zoo, where a child dropped their DS in the gorilla pen and the gorillas started to play with the console. The event took place a few months before Returns' launch, and Retro Studios took note of the event on their site. The plot to Tropical Freeze is also similar to a German Donkey Kong comic called Banana Day 24, issued in a 1996 Club Nintendo magazine. In it, DK, Diddy, Dixie, and Cranky have to save their home from being frozen over, though the similarities between the comic and game end there. Tropical Freeze on Switch interestingly makes a reference to obscure DK media, where Tox the Parrot will tell Funky Kong to give the Snomads the old banana slammer, referencing Donkey Kong's catchphrase from the Donkey Kong Country animated series.
Did you know there was almost a Metroid movie? The franchise was at its peak of popularity and acclaim after the launch of Metroid Prime in early 2003, and Retro Studios was hard at work making a sequel. Nintendo was developing Zero Mission and Metroid Prime Hunters, and they'd even contracted out a pinball game spin-off. The iron was piping hot, so Nintendo decided to go all out, and decided to make a Metroid movie too. They optioned out film rights to producers Warren Zeid and Craig Perry, best known for the Final Destination movies and American Pie. The duo released a basic plot outline in January 2003, which read, "The story is set in a once peaceful galaxy, which has its prosperity shattered by a startling discovery. On a routine mapping expedition of a planet, a survey crew discovers a new airborne life form, the Metroid. Able to engulf other living beings, feed on their energy, and multiply in great numbers, they prove a terrifying menace. Female bounty hunter Samus Aran is commissioned by the Galactic Federation to eliminate the pests, but she soon discovers that pirates with a stolen Metroid specimen are plotting to breed and build an unstoppable army. Zide and Perry were actively looking for writers, actors, and a director, but their plans ultimately went nowhere, and their rights expired in 2004. That's when the rights got snapped up by John Woo, a much more accomplished producer, with greater enthusiasm for the project. Woo's penchant for Mexican standoffs, slow motion, and stylized action scenes known as Gun Fu made him one of Hong Kong's most influential filmmakers, and a huge inspiration for Hollywood movies like The Matrix, as well as anime like Cowboy Bebop. According to Foxhoven, a producer who worked alongside Woo, we believed there was a great opportunity for John Woo to bring his style of action into a Metroid film. Nintendo was quite supportive of the idea, as they were all fans of John's previous films. Nintendo was definitely discouraged by the Super Mario Bros. Movie, but felt with John they would be in better hands. When the news broke, Foxhoven announced that they were looking to make Metroid into a big budget film, and not a quick cash grab. Samus's adventure would be fairly faithful to the games, and see her battling series staples like Mother Brain and the titular Metroids. John Woo was apparently pretty excited, telling The Hollywood Reporter, "This type of story has a proven track record of success with film audiences. We're very fortunate that there is such an extensive amount of material to draw upon for the film due to there being so many Metroid games over the years." Early script proposals focused on Samus' origin story, explaining who she was and what she did before she became the bounty hunter we know today. In an IGN interview, Foxhoven explained Samus was going to be exceptionally talented, but also very flawed, and looking for redemption. They wanted Samus to struggle, be humbled, and ultimately find it within herself to beat the odds, rather than come out the gate as some overpowered superhero. Woo's team hired several writers to provide guidance, most notably David Greenwalt, who had experience writing strong female leads from his time on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. As for who'd play the starring role, it doesn't appear Woo ever nailed down a specific actress, but Retro Studios president Michael Kelbaugh knew just the woman for the job. In late 2004, Electronic Gaming Monthly asked Kelbaugh who should play Samus in the upcoming Woo movie, and he said, "We address this question a lot. The sex of Samus is irrelevant in the video games, and we've always liked that because it never played a role in the series. It's more of a surprise than anything else. Demi Moore kind of personifies that. It doesn't matter what's underneath the helmet way of thinking. She has always been my preference to play Samus." Presumably, he'd come to the conclusion after watching A Few Good Men, G.I. Jane, and other Demi Moore movies, where she played roles typically reserved for men, but was also capable of employing traditional feminine charms when a script called for it. In early 2004, John Woo announced the film was planned to hit theaters around Christmas 2005, so by the time summer of 2004 rolled around, rumors were swirling that the movie was on schedule and production had begun. But Nintendo's Yoshio Sakamoto dispelled those rumors in Japanese gaming magazine Nintendo Dream, saying that there hadn't actually been any progress, explaining, "There were some misleading reports before E3 that Metroid's production was confirmed. But to be accurate, it's that the company that John Woo works for has gained the rights to negotiate with Nintendo of America to make Metroid into a movie." Metroid's production hasn't officially been decided yet, and there's no release plans for it. And that's the devil in the details. The contract between Nintendo and John Woo, which was never made public, didn't give Woo the authority to make the movie however he wanted. It only gave him rights to make a movie which Nintendo approved of. The biggest impediment was Samus didn't have much of an established backstory to draw from, and a movie adaptation required much more fleshing out of both character and the universe. It seems there just wasn't enough material in the games to draw from, as Woo initially thought. His team spent 3 years, just in the pre-production stages, trying to build a cohesive world and craft a story that would satisfy the Metroid fanbase and also appeal to the moviegoers who had been meeting Samus for the first time. And more importantly, the story had to gain Nintendo's approval. But according to Foxhoven, things started to go south when we tried to dig into the character a bit more. more. As you know, any film needs a deeper story arc than what's told in the game, where we learned about the characters and their world. What are they doing when they're not fighting? What is their daily existence and relationships? What are Samus's aspirations, history, and fears? Nintendo appreciated the questions, but had never thought about them before, and ultimately, didn't have a lot of answers. In the end, they felt uncomfortable with our team being the ones to propose those answers. Foxhoven went on to say they made it as far as treatment, which is the stage between the basic outline and the script's first draft. A treatment's usually between 10 and 40 pages, and details the narrative, setting, characters, themes, and particular scenes in order to secure authorization to move forward and write the full script. But after years of getting to that point, Wu's team realized they just couldn't come up with a satisfactory story that Nintendo would agree to. So, they were forced to abandon the project in 2007. Apparently, Nintendo wanted to tell Samus' story all on their own, so they started development on Metroid Other M later that same year. But when Other M released in 2010, the Metroid fanbase largely rejected that story. A few weeks later, GamesRadar asked Other M's producer and director, Yoshio Sakamoto, if there was any hope a Metroid movie could still get made someday. He told them, specifically talking about storytelling of Other M and the visual quality of computer graphics, "I think we have used quite luxurious resources to create these movie sequences, and I think these scenes are worthy of the movie label. However, if you ask me if I want Samus' story to be told in cinemas, I really don't think so." However, if Mr. Ryuji Kitaura, the director of the CG cutscenes in Other M, wants to make a Metroid movie, and if the concept and methodologies he presents are agreeable with me, then I might be okay with the idea, but only if it's made by him. Fans haven't exactly been clamoring for Nintendo to make a full-length movie in the style of Other M, but there have been some interesting ideas from third parties in the decade since. Like in 2017, when the producer of the Netflix Castlevania series, Adi Shenkar, said he'd like to make a quote-unquote Dark Metroid series in the same anime style as Castlevania. Unfortunately though, Sakamoto publicly expressed a lack of enthusiasm for Shenkar's proposal. In 2018, the director of the upcoming Metal Gear movie, Jordan Vogt Roberts, told IGN he wanted to make a Metroid film in an isolationist style, saying, "It legitimately would be Samus alone. It would be a little bit of her talking to herself. As soon as they introduce other talking characters in those games, to me, it loses everything. You put her alone, and it's almost got more to do with the silence of a movie, like Drive, like the quietness, and having it be a real intense mood piece, but mixed with sci-fi. But Nintendo will never let me. It's too crazy." Apparently, it wasn't too crazy though, because Metroid Prime senior designer Mike Wicken publicly supported the idea, even if Nintendo proper never acknowledged it. A few months later, Captain Marvel actress Brie Larson dressed as Zero Suit Samus for Halloween and repeatedly expressed a desire to play Samus on the silver screen. And the following year, Metroid manga writer Izuki Kouji said he also supported a live-action film based on the series.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.